This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Coming up on today's show, the little-known story of the Covington Blue Sox baseball team. But first, a National Center for Transgender Equality survey conducted in 2015 shows about a third of those responding who saw a healthcare provider in the previous year say they had a bad experience. 23% said they didn't even seek healthcare because of fear of being mistreated. The field of transgender medicine is still relatively new, and it's rapidly developing. Many healthcare providers aren't familiar with how to treat transgender individuals. Professors at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine have developed a curriculum to train medical students on how to care for their future transgender patients. And joining us from the UC College of Medicine, our assistant professor, Dr. Sarah Pickle, Department of Family and Community Medicine, and assistant professor, Dr. Aaron Marshall, Department of Medical Education. You can join the conversation this afternoon at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dr. Marshall and Dr. Pickle, thanks to both of you for being here today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
This is such a new and fast-evolving area, and I think we need to do some definitions first of what we're talking about. And let's start with what's the difference between gender and sex?
Well, that's a great question, because gender and sex are different. Sometimes we use them interchangeably, but they shouldn't be used interchangeably. They are different, and they both exist on a continuum, which is a new concept for a lot of people. Sex is assigned at birth, or with advancing technologies, sometimes it's assigned even before birth, while an individual is still pregnant. Sex can be different than gender, and sometimes it is. Gender is how one defines their own identity. So how do you relate to the world around you, and who are you as a person? This could be male, female, neither, both, or somewhere in the middle of the spectrum. We contrast that to gender expression, which is the way that you convey yourself to the world. So how do you tell the world what your gender identity is? And that's very much a cultural phenomenon, because things that may be considered gender-specific in one culture may be very different than other cultures. So sometimes sex, or sex assigned at birth, and gender don't match. And when they don't match, that can cause individuals a lot of distress. And when they do experience distress, the term that we use is gender dysphoria.
Okay, good. Now, gender dysphoria, go a little bit more into that.
So some patients who are experiencing this discrepancy between who they were told they were supposed to be when they were born and who they know they are will feel anxiety, sadness. They may want to live a life that feels most authentic to them. And those are patients that we would use the term gender dysphoria to describe what they're experiencing. Those might also be the patients who would seek the care of a medical professional in order to talk about what treatments exist to help alleviate this gender dysphoria. Another term that's probably worth defining is, what do we mean when we say transgender?
Yes, thank you. Okay.
Because transgender is really a broad term that's used to describe any group of individual or individual who feels this discrepancy between their sex they were assigned and their gender. So it's a broad term, and then within that term, we sometimes use, or patients might use, terms such as transgender male, which could be used to describe somebody assigned female sex at birth, but who may identify as male, masculine, or a man. Similarly, a transgender female may have been assigned a male sex at birth, but may define themselves as their gender identity as being female, feminine, or a woman. So that's also a term that we want to make sure that we're using correctly, so that we can really help individuals who are also using that term feel like they're connecting to the providers or health professionals that they're seeing.
So what does the term gender nonconforming mean? Is that the same thing as transgender?
In some ways, gender nonconforming can be a term that fits under the broader term of transgender. So somebody who's gender nonconforming may not conform or kind of confine to male or female gender normalities of that culture. So again, kind of a cultural phenomenon. So they may feel gender neutral. They may feel that they encompass both female and male gender characteristics. So it can be a term that's used in a few different ways. I think the important thing when a patient comes in and they may describe themselves as any of these terms that we've used, a really important thing that providers and healthcare professionals can do is explore what that term means to them, because it can be different depending on how a patient chooses to use it.
And Dr. Marshall, is that the starting point when students start studying this? They have to get this terminology down and understand all these distinctions?
Oh, absolutely. The articulate way Dr. Pickle just described these terms is exactly how we start our transgender medicine curriculum. Students come in generally with some sort of idea of what these terms mean, but often there are details missing. So I think we start out by explaining these terms, and then we subsequently go on to explain how to care for these patients and so on.
Mm-hmm. How many students are involved in this particular program?
So the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine matriculates approximately 175 students per year, and all of them are taking a prescribed curriculum, and this transgender medicine curriculum is a part of that prescribed curriculum, so they all encounter it.
Okay. Are there a lot of schools across the country, a lot of medical schools that are doing this?
No. So the most recent data out there is a 2011 survey of osteopathic as well as allopathic medical schools, and they showed that roughly less than 30% are addressing transgenderism or the process of transition specifically. So we certainly saw an opportunity there to help our students develop a certain prowess of cultural competence in dealing with a population of patients who are otherwise underserved.
And I think you hit it with that opening statistic, Mark, is that when a fourth of a patient's won't see a doctor because they're worried about how they'll be treated, and a third who are treated maybe can't even afford the treatment, you know, there's a lot of things that we in the medical community can do to make patients' experience be the most gender-affirming, meaning regardless of where you define on the gender or sex spectrum, we as healthcare providers are prepared to care for you. And in order to prepare a future generation of doctors, we have to start early in their clinical training. So part of our curriculum starts right now in their second year of medical school. Last year, it started in their first year of medical school. So, our students have not even really started to see a large number of patients yet, but we are going to prepare them with the tools that they need so that when they do encounter patients that are identify as transgender, gender nonconforming, or who may have issues related to gender, students know the best way to care for patients using the best evidence that we have out there.
Dr. Pickle, when did the medical community realize they're needed to be a focus on learning how to treat people who are transgender? When did all this start?
So we have data back from the 40s and 50s that start showing that transgender patients were not being well cared for by the medical community in a lot of communities. The 2015 survey that you reported on certainly shows that we have a long way to go. I think as a medical community, what we can do is train providers like myself, who's a primary care provider. So not only do patients come to see me because they may want to talk about transition or talk about their hormone therapy or transgender care, but all of those other health conditions that affect all patients, making sure their blood pressure is okay, making sure their weight's okay, making sure they have their birth control needs met, all of those other things that we think about for all patients are part of the care that we need to train our physicians and our clinicians to do for all individuals, including our transgender patients.
And I would add that it was actually a student a few years ago who approached me about starting a transgender medicine curriculum because they recognized that what they were being offered thus far was something called the LGBT curriculum. So this is something a lot of medical schools do, where the acronym is easy to roll off the tongue, and it encompasses a group of people, all who fall under the underserved population in terms of healthcare needs. But when you lump all those letters together, you end up only teaching about things that are common amongst all those populations of people. And that ignores some of the unique aspects of transgender medicine, such as gender-affirming hormone therapy or gender-confirming surgery. These aspects would not be taught in a wider LGBT curriculum. And it was students who recognized this first and said, you know, it would be great to learn a little bit more details about what medications or what surgery options there are, and just in general, how to take care of these patients, because chances are they will have one in their practice.
When did UC start this curriculum?
This first iteration was in, 2016, excuse me.
Okay, 2016. And Dr. Pickle, did you want to add something in there?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think our approach to the curriculum is the same way that any physician would approach a patient that they're seeing. The first thing that we teach our students is to, get your language down, know your terminology, figure out the best way that you can use language to connect with your patient, to build a rapport with your patient. Then the next thing we taught students to think about is look at that patient as an entire person, their entire narrative, their entire story. What else do they have going on that could affect their health outcomes? So that's screening for things like sexually transmitted infections, intimate partner violence, other health problems that they may have. So again, this is not only about hormones or surgery. This is about the patient as an entire person. And that's something that in our curriculum, we really try to enforce with our students. And then teaching them some of the more intricate parts of transgender medicine. How do hormonal medications work? Kind of bringing it back to their basic science courses of endocrinology and physiology, which is definitely Dr. Marshall's expertise. And allowing them to have a full context to understand what's the best way to care for these patients. And we reviewed what guidelines are out there that guide all clinicians in best care. So again, that they have a scaffolding for their future careers, whether they prescribe hormone medications in the future, whether they're surgeons in the future, they will all encounter patients who have a wide variety of gender identities. And so we really wanted them to be prepared for those interactions.
We will continue our conversation about transgender medicine. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us from the UC College of Medicine to discuss training medical providers to treat transgender patients, our assistant professor, Dr. Sarah Pickle, Department of Family and Community Medicine, and assistant professor, Dr. Aaron Marshall, Department of Medical Education. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dr. Marshall, how tough is it for medical providers today to keep up with information on transgender patients? And are primary care providers, are they equipped to treat these patients, or do they typically need to send them to a specialist?
It probably varies. Certainly the field of transgender medicine is relatively new. And although there are resources out there for the general practitioner as well as the specialist, certainly I think that most graduating students or soon to be doctors are not familiar with these guidelines, or maybe only perhaps where to find them. And that is certainly one of our goals of this curriculum at the College of Medicine, is to give students a superficial look at these guidelines and understanding, as Dr. Pickle was saying earlier, that the patient is an individual and may have different needs because of the care they're under, whether it be gender-affirming hormone therapy or some other kind of care. And so, I think Dr. Pickle can speak more to its prevalence in clinical practice?
Yeah, so I think that there's a lot of different types of clinicians who are able to treat patients who might be coming in for gender-affirming care. Certainly endocrinologists who have a specialty practice within hormone therapy and hormonal care are certainly well-equipped to treat these patients. And we have a lot of wonderful endocrinologists here at the University of Cincinnati who also see these patients. I myself am a primary care provider. And as a family medicine doctor, I see patients from birth till death and everywhere in between. Part of my training after my residency training was to get specific training providing this type of care. And so one of the things that I really enjoy about being a primary care provider, providing gender-affirming care, is I have the ability to treat patients beyond their hormone therapy. So if they come in with a sinus infection or they come in and they need their toenail removed, I'm able to see them for multiple levels of care. So I think each specialist or each provider who is able to interface with the transgender community, regardless of their specialty, has a really important role. If we look at the healthcare disparities and the discrepant care that transgender patients get versus the non-transgender U.S. population, there's a lot of room for improvement. So the more providers we have, increases the access to care. So part of what we want to teach our students is that if you're interested in this type of care, don't let your specialty of choice in the future prevent you from being excellent providers of transgender care. Let's teach all of our students, regardless of what they go into, how to do this really well.
What are some of the health disparities that transgender patients face?
So we know that as far as just access to care in general, about 1 in 4 patients who responded to that survey that you referred to in 2015 just have a problem about getting insurance related to being transgender. So they could be denied coverage because of how they identify, or they may have been denied coverage related to their gender transition, denied coverage for medications, denied coverage for surgery. So the first issue is just access to care in general. We know that there is a higher rate of intimate partner violence and violence towards transgender patients because of stigma. These are things that healthcare providers have to be aware of so that we can screen for these possible physical or sexual assaults in patients who are coming in. We know that because of this stigma related to gender, oftentimes patients will come in with mental health conditions that we really need to make sure that we're addressing well as a healthcare community so that not only are we helping patients alleviate gender dysphoria and helping them, you know, live a life that feels aligned with their gender identity. But if they have other mental health conditions, depression or anxiety related to gender issues or unrelated, that we're doing a good job at addressing all of those healthcare needs.
How complex a process is it to make that transition, to alter your birth sex?
So when patients come in and they're seeking care to alleviate this dysphoria, it's a very individualized process. Just like we may not treat all other health conditions the same, this is a very individualized treatment process. Some patients may take part in multiple stages of treatment. There are things like medications and hormone therapy, multiple different types of surgeries that are available. And all of these medical interventions are really designed to help patients live their happiest, healthiest, safest life. And that's what doctors are trying to do for all patients. And so really the interventions and the treatments that we are able to offer patients may take a wide variety of options. Therapy can be a really important part of patients' transition as well. This could be individual counseling, couples counseling, family counseling. And some of the reasons people might engage in therapy would be to explore gender roles, talking about the negative impact of gender dysphoria or stigma that they may face, talking about how to enhance their peer support, promoting resilience, especially in younger patients, adolescent and pediatric geriatric patients, oftentimes therapy is focused on how can we support these patients? How can we make sure that they're safe? And again, each of these parts of treatment, therapy, medication, surgery, may be part of somebody's transition process or may not be part of somebody's transition process. And I think just like gender identities and expressions are very diverse, so are the options available to patients who want treatment.
But it sounds like the process is not something that happens quickly. This is a longer-term process. Is that?
For many patients, it is a long-term process. I think a lot of the patients that I see have known from a very young age that the sex they were assigned at birth is not who they are. They can relate stories from childhood and adolescence of feeling very strong feelings of gender dysphoria. And they may be coming to me to seek treatment later in their lives because they feel like they are ready to live the life that feels most aligned and they're ready to live the life that feels most authentic. So many patients have had a really long journey and process that doesn't involve me sometimes till years or decades later. But it's different for each patient. And as healthcare providers, and what we try to teach our students is, let's meet the patients where they are so that we can help them move forward, whatever their transition might look like.
And Dr. Marshall, are there medical ethical guidelines in place for treating those with gender dysphoria, or is that still a developing area?
Yes, there is. There are guidelines put out by various professional societies that deal with these medical ethical guidelines you ask about. We don't teach the specifics of that to our students yet because, as Dr. Pickle was alluding to, a lot of this falls under specialty training that she was fortunate enough to get. But the goal here is just to give the students an awareness of the options that are out there, and so they can prevent a negative experience by a transgender patient who may be seeing them for the first time. And so that is ultimately our goal.
So there are evidence-based guidelines that have evolved so much over the last 50 to 60 years about how do we as healthcare providers help patients live their healthiest lives? What doses of medication should we start? What surgery should be offered? What are some of the criteria that we can use in order to make sure that patients are choosing the best outcomes for them? So I view my role certainly with my patients as, I know the guidelines and the evidence, and I share that with them. And then together we talk about what things might be part of their journey or their process. So there are certainly guidelines out there. They are robust in their evidence and becoming more and more robust as things like this happen, where we talk as a community about what evidence exists, but what do we still need to know? What's still out there that we're not sure about yet?
Yeah, so it's an ever-developing field. What is next? Any ideas?
Well, one of the areas of current research right now is we know for transgender patients that they may have an unmet need when it comes to birth control as well as fertility options. So one of the areas of research and one of my areas of interest is how to make sure that patients' reproductive health needs are met regardless of the sex they were assigned at birth or their gender. So that's one area certainly of kind of research and interest that allows some opportunity for us to get more information. I think the other thing is just in medical education. So our curriculum was recently published on the on a website that helps other schools learn how to teach this and implement this type of program. Because one of the things we need to become better at is figuring out, as medical schools, how to do this and how to do it well.
Well, Dr. Marshall, Dr. Pickle, thank you for joining us this afternoon. From the UC College of Medicine, Assistant Professor Dr. Sarah Pickle, Department of Family and Community Medicine, and Assistant Professor Dr. Aaron Marshall from the Department of Medical Education.